Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, June 30th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Richard Robohm. Today's session number is ROR 2001-07, and it's titled, Go Ahead, Make My Earth Day, The Wilderness Ethic. Let's listen in.
I'm going to start off with a couple of readings. The first, a poem by Theodore Rethke. Theodore Rethke grew up in the Midwest, in Ohio, I think, and his father was a nurseryman, or plantsman, and an alcoholic. And this was a source of tremendous grief, of course, but Rethke also was fond of his father, and one of his most famous poems is My Papa's Waltz, which is written in 3/4 time. It's a lovely poem. It starts out, the whiskey on your breath could make a small boy dizzy, but I held on like death. Such waltzing was not easy. And it goes on. But I'm reading another poem by Theodore Rethke. This one is called Moss Gathering. And of course, working for a plantsman, this is something that he helped to do. To loosen with all 10 fingers held wide and limber, and lift up a patch, dark green, the kind for lining cemetery baskets, thick and cushiony like an old-fashioned doormat, the crumbling small hollow sticks on the underside mixed with roots, and wintergreen berries and leaves still stuck to the top. That was moss gathering. But something always went out of me when I dug loose those carpets of green, or plunged my elbows in the spongy, yellowish moss of the marshes. And afterwards, I always felt mean, jogging back over the logging road, as if I had broken the natural order of things in that swampland, disturbed some rhythm, old and of vast importance, by pulling off flesh from the living planet, as if I had committed, against the whole scheme of life, a desecration. Well, what is it that gives a young boy to think in those terms? And what is it that gives other people not to think in those terms at all? Who can, without a twinge of compunction, denude a slope, a landscape, pulpit, convert it to whatever it is that they can make the most money from. I don't know where that connection to nature comes from. Some people have it when they're young, some people get it when they're older. But I think it does entail some sense of sacrament with respect to nature. Now, I have to confess to you that I am a secular person, but I have kind of an arbitrary conviction that goodness is the best moral principle on which to base one's life. It just seems to work out better that way. And I have the same attitude toward the natural world, that that which promotes it, and this is an echo of what Aldo Leopold, the ecologist who finished his career at Wisconsin, said, that which promotes the unity and the well-being and the wholeness of the natural world is good, and that which detracts from it is bad. Well, that's a simple enough thing. Of course, once we get into questions of economics and the welfare of our communities and our children and the things that we really think ought to be done on behalf of all those good people, we find that not all of our impacts on the environment are friendly ones. I think we have to accept that we do have impacts, and that our role as stewards is to minimize them. In fact, that's the language of the National Environmental Policy Act and of the most of the state environmental policy acts, which are modeled after it. And they have a hierarchy of terms. First, one should avoid impacts. Second, one should minimize impacts, rectify impacts when they occur, mitigate for impacts, and so forth. And I think that has to be the guide we follow. And we also have to be sure that the lives we lead are consistent with sustainability over the long term. Paul Ehrlich is an ecologist, a population biologist, and an entomologist that's an insect scientist. And to put a fine point on it, he's a lepidopterist, which is a butterfly scientist. But he's quite erudite. He had a famous bet with an economist back in 1970. The bet was that in 10 years, the prices of a series of commodities would go up because it was all becoming more scarce and we were living beyond our means on the planet as a whole. And they named, I think, tin, copper, silver, gold, something like that. Well, all of the prices went down, much to Paul Ehrlich's chagrin. He's the one that wrote the population bomb back around 1970, and he appeared on Johnny Carson frequently and was an articulate advocate for environmental causes and for zero population growth. What Ehrlich said was, well, it doesn't really disprove my point. It was a stupid bet to have made in the first place. It doesn't prove anything. We're still living beyond our means. And just because we had a worldwide recession in the intervening 10 years, and just because we managed to find some substitutes for some of these metals, doesn't prove that we're not living unsustainably. Well, maybe so and maybe not. I don't know. I don't think any of us can really be certain of that. I think it is clear that there are many impacts of economic activity, of just living on this earth, that are not accounted for in the prices we pay for things. The price of gasoline doesn't pay for the pollution of the atmosphere. The price of fertilizer doesn't pay for the pollution of rivers and lakes and groundwater from the runoff of excess nitrogen. All of those things are what economists call externalities. That is, they're not accounted for in the transaction between buyer and seller of the goods or services involved. And there have been efforts to do what economists call internalize the externalities, which is to put a price or a tax that represents that unaccounted for cost. And that can be done by raising a tax on gasoline. One time somebody, Paul Tsongas, I think it was talking about a 50-cent a gallon gas tax when he was running for president in the Democratic primary back 8 years ago, a little more than 8 years ago. Didn't go over. People aren't ready to pay that price and suffer the consequences of doing so. People who have to drive long distances for a living would be affected in a big way. But those are the kinds of tough decisions that we're faced with, and chances are we're not going to really face up to them until we encounter a crisis. Very gradually, incrementally, we have gotten to the point where there are more controls on pollution. We now pay for catalytic converters in our car, and they're not cheap because they use platinum. And we're using gas with no lead in it. There are other things that government regulations have imposed on us not in the form of a direct consumer tax, but in the form of insisting that things be done in a certain way, which actually does cost us a little more. Anyway, I want to read one other thing from Wendell Berry, and then I want to invite your own comments, observations, horror stories, and talk about how we ought to approach the problems that we're facing, or how we might. From Wendell Berry, this is a series of essays called Another Turn of the Crank, which it's a title that I appreciate more now that I realize that he's making fun of himself here, too. It didn't strike me initially, but then, of course, it's obvious, because a lot of what he says is, it's very much from the point of view of a social critic and one who is far off the beaten path. But this is not, I think. In The Idea of a Christian Society, T.S. Eliot wrote, "We may say that religion, as distinguished from modern paganism, implies a life in conformity with nature. It may be observed that the natural life and the supernatural life have a conformity to each other which neither has with the mechanistic life." I am an empiricist. I follow the tradition of Descartes and some other folks, Locke, Hobbes, Hume, people of the Enlightenment who really based their view of the world on what was accessible to the senses. However, I also accept that there are some things that are simply not quantifiable and not capable of elucidation by the means that science employs, for example. And I'm glad for that. That gives mystery to life, that gives poetry to life. And some people put that in a spiritual dimension, and some people put it in an aesthetic or philosophical or artistic one, as I do. But I can endorse what T.S. Eliot said, and I can certainly endorse Wendell Berry's quoting him. And Wendell Berry, in the same essay, talks about the question of endangered species. And he uses the story of the shepherd and the sheep. One of the strongest strands of our religious tradition, it is probably the most essential strand, according to which a shepherd owning 100 sheep and having lost one does not say, "I have saved 99% of my sheep," but rather, "I have lost one." And he goes and searches for the one. And if the sheep in that parable may seem to be only a metaphor, then go on to the Gospel of Luke, where the principle is flatly set forth again, and where the sparrows stand not for human beings, but for all creatures. Are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 farthings, and not one of them is forgotten before God? And he concludes, an ecosystem minus one species is a different ecosystem. Just so, each of us is made by, or one might better say, made as, a set of unique associations with unique persons, places, and things. The world of love does not admit the principle of the interchangeability of parts. Which, of course, is a fundamental economic principle, that there are substitutes for everything. Which is why the price of copper and gold went down, because we made integrated circuits. They used to consume vast amounts of copper wire, and the highest quality would use gold. We were able to use silicon.
Curiosity, yeah. Question. Is silicon a man-made element or man-made?
It's a natural element, and it's refined into a form that makes it very useful as a semiconductor.
Okay, but we don't mine silicon.
Silicon, I don't know where we get silicon, actually.
Okay, and I apologize. I don't mean to take us off the subject, but I was just wondering again if we dig it out of the ground or if we make it in the laboratory.
No, it comes. It's a natural element in the earth.
Okay,
I think it's just silica.
But yeah, basically, it's abundant. Sand is silicon dioxide. Yeah, and the semiconductors are very effective because they've got a. They can easily go either way, and the outer shell of electrons, the normal layer, a complement of 8, if something has the atomic weight of silicon, and it's got 4 electrons in the outer shell, and so it can either take 4 or it can give away 4. It's not like copper, which really wants to get 1. So silicon readily switches back and forth. It gives 1 up or it takes 1. So, a little off the track, too. Anyway, who has an observation or a story to tell or a thought or an idea regarding some ecological disaster in your area or some restoration project?
I think the new dynamic that's in the mix that not enough people realize is all the things we've ever done to the earth before could probably take care of themselves in time, regenerate, so to speak. Somehow they were reversible in time, in a fairly short time frame, you know, whatever the form of pollution might be. But we've got one that really bothers me now that isn't reversible. I mean, we all know that. If global warming is real, and the evidence is increasing that it is, you know, that it's happening, that it's made by man, not by nature, the consequences are just unbelievable for future generations. I mean, just incredible. And not just people, but the whole ecosystem. Well, I mean, the people are related to the ecosystem, obviously. If masses of species die off and the temperatures go up by 5 or 10 degrees, it's just unimaginable what the consequences are going to be. All these people would say, oh, the grain fields will just move a few hundred miles north and everything will be fine. That ain't true. So, a new dynamic. It's not fixable in the short term by nature or anything man can do.
Right. Not by any means that are available to us now.
The magnitude of it, I can't imagine what the means would be. I mean, you can put some temporary little stopgap things on in a rich country like the United States. You know, you can build dikes to keep the sea out. You can move agriculture for the first few years, or pump some water down from the Arctic or something to irrigate the fields that are all burning up, or you know what I mean? And that's the kind of thing we will do, you know? But once that stuff is up there, it's thousands and thousands of years before it reverts back again.
I mean, we are starting processes. I mean, if we look the next 100 years, 200 years, I mean, all the reservoirs that are producing water, electricity, and such are going to silt up so that there'll be meadows, and those sites will be lost as far as production of electricity. The irrigation of land and saltation of the land from irrigated water is building up. The brown water is going down. I mean, we are really writing a scenario that is pretty problematic.
And nuclear waste is another stunning. I had in Iowa, where we have older nuclear plants, I had no clue until I read it that after 30 to 50 years, every single one of the plants in Iowa is going to be buried in dirt, and they're going to put a large barbed wire fence that's 8 feet high around the whole thing, and they'll put electricity through the top several wires so that nobody can get anywhere near it for hundreds of years. And there it will sit, buried in dirt, until its radioactivity, presumably over thousands of years, will get expended. And I'm thinking to myself, what are we doing? I mean, it's just stunning. You use it for 30 years, and then you preserve it for hundreds or thousands of years. It sounds so stupid to me, I just can't grasp it.
And then you have a president who, and a vice president who come up with an energy policy that says, you know, hey, this is not our problem right now, let's put that off for 100 years or 200, and let's focus more on nuclear power and coal-burning electrical plants. And I'm a high school economics teacher. And so for me, I'm so environmental that I try to stay as neutral as possible with my children, not my children, but my students. And I present this week the whole unit on the energy crisis, especially I'm from Portland, Oregon, in the Northwest, what's going on, and stay neutral. It was extremely difficult, and have my students come back to me and say, it's not us, it's, you know, this is the cycle of the earth. I just didn't know what to do at that point, so.
We were talking about this the other day, the glacier that melts up here, Upper Lyman, or Lyman Glacier, Mount Lyman Glacier, comes down Railroad Creek, down to, goes down into Chelan Lake, and then slowly would filter out to Columbia River, and then we think about how it goes to so many dams, so many series of dams, and all the nitrification from the farms and stuff like that, and by the time, you know, this crisp, pure place that comes out, by the time it gets to Portland, it's so polluted. People don't want to swim in it, really, and it's just, to me, that's really an issue in Portland, because, you know, the salmon, the issue of endangered species, certain types of salmon and stuff, and it's a really tough thing, because you think about it, what always gets me is that, you know, the largest population growth right now is like in Arizona, and these areas that are not sustainable for large populations. And that's exactly what the case is in, for the Columbia River, is that you have farms that have blossomed and done very well in systems that are not supposed to be there. They're in deserts. And I was driving out there. I was there 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago in eastern Washington, and they water day and night. And day, you might as well just throw the water up and let it evaporate. It's very wasteful. And what's hard is that it seems like in our cultures, we either have to go one way or the other. We can't find that conservation that would be, you know, to have, you know, ask these farmers to say, you know, turn those off, and in the day, they're pretty much, in the, you know, you're basically watering the air anyways. You know, it was very discouraging to see that, because I thought that there was more conservation, but they just, it's water that's very cheap for them. The government subsidizes it, and it's a really tough issue, because now we've already taken the Columbia and made it to what we have now. So it's an issue of going backwards, and it's tough. It's a rough issue, because you have a lot of people that are dependent on that water and that cheap form of, you know, energy.
Yeah. And it's so tragic that we had a point where we could go on in one direction with the Gore administration, and somebody like Babbitt, who started tearing down dams, at least making the steps in the right direction, and we've completely gone backwards at a time that is absolutely critical to make decisions for the future.
The water law in the West, generally, and in the state of Washington in particular, is based on the principle of first dare, first right, and also use it or lose it. And so the farmers have a disincentive to conserve, and they have that water, they were promised that water, guaranteed it. When the Grand Coulee Dam was built and they filled up this huge coulee left over from the floods of the Lake Missoula that swept across the state repeatedly during the recession of the last ice age, it's a huge reservoir, and they use the electricity generated by the dam to pump it up onto the Columbia Basin, and then they've got a series of canals, network of them, to irrigate it. It's a system that was designed with none of the thinking of the 21st century that we have now. The dam was seen as a godsend. A progressive like Woody Guthrie wrote peons to the Bonneville Power Administration.
And wasn't job creation one of the biggest
problems? Yeah, it was job creation. It was make the desert bloom. It was, roll on, Columbia. Your power is turning our darkness to dawn. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. There's a lot of that thinking of the mastery of nature, the march of progress, and people who were socially progressive during the 30s and 40s were not, by and large, ecologically or environmentally aware. We have a different consciousness now, but we are stuck in a mentality that is 100 years old. And of course, there were voices in the 19th century, certainly, if not before, where people like Thoreau and Emerson and John Muir at the turn of the century expressed an affinity and appreciation for nature that was far ahead of their time. All of these dams came along, and there were a puny few who stood against them, and a great majority who stood with them.
John Wesley Powell was a good example. First person went through the Grand Canyon, but he was one of the early commissioners of the Geological Society, and essentially wrote the government thesis on the arid lands and about how you are not to overdevelop a very arid area. And it's very ironic that Lake Powell, which he was totally against, was named after him.
Yeah. The question of global warming, I know there are still some people who delude themselves into thinking that the process is not, in fact, occurring, but the scientific consensus overwhelmingly is that it's a fact, and in fact, the Bush administration, Condoleezza Rice, has acknowledged that. They were denying it at the Tokyo conference, but now they do accept that global warming is occurring and that we need to do something about it. They think what we need to do is study it more. The whole idea of why we have global warming, maybe most of you know this, but I want to talk about the potential solutions to the problem. Global warming, the greatest contributor to it is carbon dioxide. And there are other greenhouse gases, methane. Methane actually, pound per pound, contributes 10 times as much to global warming as CO2. But it's still a much smaller factor.
And is methane what comes out of gasoline residue? Burning gasoline?
No, methane comes from
decomposition.
Yeah, it comes from anaerobic respiration, and a lot of it comes from cows, actually. Breaking wind. And landfills. Yeah. Landfills have they flare off methane and vent it, and there are a few others. But these are some of the major culprits. Back when the Earth was young, the concentration of carbon dioxide was much, much greater than it is today. And there was virtually no oxygen in the atmosphere. The air was poisonous for us and all other creatures like us to breathe. As plants began to multiply, first in the sea and then on land, they took this CO2 and added water to it and made sugar plus oxygen, also a little bit of water. But anyway, the important thing is that they took carbon dioxide and converted it to sugar and oxygen, and over millennia, over eons, the concentration of oxygen increased to the level where normal air-breathing creatures could survive on the planet. Well, we have been reversing that process because all of the carbon that the plants sequestered, either in standing timber or in living plants, or in the soils or buried under the soils, has been dug up, trees have been cut down and burned, and most importantly, petroleum and coal, which were formed by fossil plants, has been pulled out of the earth and oxidized, burned, and turned into carbon dioxide. That's our big problem. So reversing that means that we stop burning all this carbon and that we grow more plants. Apart from any kind of massive industrial solution that we might be able to devise, I would think it would be some sort of bio-industrial solution that might mitigate some of the effects of global warming, but it would have to be on a massive scale, and the cost is incalculable. On the other hand, also incalculable is the cost of all of our coastal cities drowning as the sea levels rise, as the polar ice caps melt. And we will have a shifting of species, and we'll have a probably much more turbulent weather, because if we're taking more energy into the planet instead of reflecting it back, if we're warming up, then we're going to have much more energetic storms, hurricanes, tornadoes, tidal waves, who knows?
I try to follow fuel cell development. Is there any possibility that, in your mind at least, that fuel cells might be a helpful response to the whole dilemma?
Well, I think so. Actually, I look forward in my lifetime to the fading out of the internal combustion engine.
You still have to split off the hydrogen somehow. You know, I mean, it takes energy to split off the hydrogen.
Right.
To make the hydrogen to run the fuel cells. So
yeah.
You've either, hydroelectric dams, you can do it with generators that are powered by what? They got to be powered by something.
Right.
You don't completely escape the loop. You have to produce energy to make the hydrogen. And that's the one thing that people don't talk about a whole bunch when they talk about fuel cells. The fuel cells themselves don't make any CO2, but you have to make the fuel to run the fuel cell.
Right. Well, our solar collectors are becoming more efficient and more economical.
But that takes a political will to move to those solar collectors.
Sure.
They still aren't as efficient as digging oil out of the ground or coal.
Right, if you don't take into account the external costs.
Right, but, I mean, we won't take them into account, or we'd have a gas tax right now.
Yeah.
I don't see where this magic bullet's going to come from to move us to fuel cells.
Economics and politics are very much intertwined.
Obviously.
Economics are based on markets. Markets are based on what people are willing to pay for. And if people are willing to pay for organic food, then we'll shift from industrial farming to more and more organic farming, because the demand will attract producers to that mode of production. In the same way, we can impose our economic or our political will in the marketplace as well as in the political arena to force some of these solutions. Now, the problem is that most people are content to just muddle along. They have other preoccupations. They just can't put all that energy. They may be exhausted and fall into bed every night after taking, doing a job and a half plus all of the household and kids and responsibilities. And don't talk to me about global warming. I'm going to warm this kid's behind. I think there's a particular responsibility on the part of folks who do have some time and some understanding to seek out ways that they can spread the word, and also make sure that the elected officials and the people in positions to enforce regulations understand exactly what we have in mind.
Yeah, but it's a little discouraging, I think, that like in the area where we live in the last election, we saw somewhat of a backlash in a sort of a farming area where even the mainstream Republicans were voted out, and the real conservative ones that didn't want any regulations at all were swept in, you know. Mm-hmm.
Around the salmon issue, which is all related to stuff.
Yeah, farmers are, I don't know if there's that many, the farmers have that many clout, but for, you know, whatever reason, perception was there's too many damn regulations and you know, we're going to get the Republicans out, and we're going to put in the real property rights people, and and that's what happened. So so that's kind of discouraging. And I mean, I guess even the kind of the global warming with and the nuclear issues with the Bush administration, I feel the same way too. When they say this is great, we'll go to nuclear power, and I'm thinking we don't know how to take care of the waste. How can you even say that so flip? But you know, they just keep saying it, and I'm sort of bewildered. You know although I guess I think Christy Whitman and whatever the Treasury Secretary, Paul somebody, they're really concerned about global warming. So I guess I'm happy that at least I think there's a couple voices that are saying. But I guess I'm a little bit suspect that, you know, when you hear the Bush administration said, oh, yeah, well, I guess we do need to think about global warming. Maybe they're just kind of saying that to...
They're reading the poll.
It's just kind of like, okay, let's just say we're concerned about it and we won't really do anything, you know. We'll just say we're going to study it.
Throw them a poll.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there is what I think is a very positive thing, and that is that as a mission developer, I went around an upscale neighborhood trying to get people interested in starting a new parish. There's one issue on which all of those younger families who were like from 30 to 45, one thing on which they were all agreed, and that is concern for the earth and the world in which we live. Now, whether they're able to do much about it is another thing, but that is a common new strata of value that I think is in a large part of our generations moving towards maturity.
I think that's true. I think there's a concern on the broad thing, and then you would say, and to help, you know, do something about it, we need to have a Kansas gas tax. I think they would say, well, no, we don't want to go that far, you know. No. I mean, I think, that, you know.
That's what the polls show. They have a concern, and they know there's something out there, but when it comes down to specifics of doing something in your lifestyle, no.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, people want to go on to Alaska, you know. Let's go for that oil. That's the solution right now. Yeah, I'm concerned about the earth, but hey, let's go for that oil because we know it's there. Let's develop it.
No, last year
I think
when,
that's what...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when gas went to, you know, around $2 a gallon back in the Midwest and other places, people actually demanded, and a few state legislatures, in fact, did roll back some of the state part of the gas tax. Literally went in the opposite direction of where we need to be going. Just because gas went up to, you know, a little bit approached more where it should be if you want to talk about the real cost.
What about? I mean, that's peanuts. I mean, you know, I got into trouble on this subject from the pulpit 20 years ago when we had a spike in 70 on gas prices.
Uh-huh.
The price for, and missionaries wrote back to us, and I happened to bring this up in a sermon. They laughed when they read the Newsweek magazine, this is in Tanzania, because folks were paying $5 a quart for gasoline in Tanzania back in 1970. And here we were complaining about gas at $2 a gallon, which was a temporary spike. You know, it's just ludicrous compared to what other parts of the world who are a little more sensitive to these issues than were 30 years ago.
Yeah. Well, there are people who burn gas for a living, basically. Truck drivers, cab drivers, Other folks who depend on burning those fossil fuels, and they don't see any alternative to how they're making a living now. There aren't any ready substitutes for them, and so they're not ready to go along with that. If they were in this room, we'd have a brouhaha. Mm-hmm.
Well, everybody looks out for their own interests. Right. Just like we were talking the other night, why don't all the Lutheran bishops just see the light and change the rights regarding who can be pastors? And what it boiled down to is, I don't know if you were in the room, but economics was, you know,
yeah,
that was kind of the consensus. That was the fear, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they're afraid for their own jobs.
Yeah.
Their own parishes, the survival of them, and so forth and so on. And we're all, well, you know, I mean, I'm sure that if you push my button, I probably, oh, not me, you know.
Well, that's true. We have environmental regulations, but you're wanting to do a little, you know, modification of a part of our business. We ran up across the regulation, which we thought was, would a difference if we did what we wanted to do, move something a little bit closer to a wetland. But no, there's the 100-foot thing, and even though it's down, you know, or up the hill or whatever, you know, down the hill where it wouldn't run in there. No,
actually,
you know,
make things better.
Mm-hmm. And we thought it would actually, you know, be better for the whole ecosystem. Try to explain that. Nope, this is the regulation, 100 feet, and so I can see, you know, why. In theory, you know, when we would be classed in that, you know, environmentally, where people sometimes it comes down to your own personal thing, and you think the regulation is really stupid, or you know, supposed. And sometimes that happens. The regulations.
Some of them are stupid.
They somehow the way they're played out don't can go overboard or not really.
They don't accomplish the goals.
So yeah, don't accomplish the goals.
Well, I think that speaks to one of the problems that people who are charged with enforcing regulations have. I'm in the middle on that. I am a wetland ecologist, and I work for a consulting firm, so my clients, for the most part, are private, although they do include municipalities, universities. When I work for a city, they'll have me review somebody else's wetland report and say whether or not I think it meets professional standards and that their conclusions are reasonable. But I'm well aware of the point of view of both the homeowners or property owners and of the regulators on these issues. And I find it's helpful to be able to articulate what they're thinking in words that they would agree with on both sides. I think that in order to communicate effectively with people who don't already share your own point of view, that it's good to really understand it well enough that you can argue their case as if you were them, and they would say, yes, that's it exactly. And if you can get to that point of understanding, then I think you might be able to find a way to build a bridge. Because if you don't know where your bridge is going, you're liable to end up hanging in midair.
I had a question. I was curious. I actually used to be an environmental chemist, and one guy said that the space shuttle uses as much ozone as car consumption expends in 1 year. I don't know if what's the breakdown for like the greenhouse gases, as in like carbon dioxide and methane, for like military, because I think that's something that's never really talked about. And it's, I mean, you see all these jets flying by, right. You know, they never talk about conservation, at least from what I understand.
Yeah, well, I really don't know. Is the space shuttle producing ozone or destroying ozone?
Destroying.
Okay, so that would be something, some of the gases that are released,
right,
that go up into the ionosphere, troposphere, and destroy the ozone.
Maybe ammonia or freon refrigerated
some of the freon. They use a lot of freon coolest tanks before they But it's just something, you know, something, those large scale things that might be changed, I could make a huge difference other than, I don't know, I always find it interesting that it's always turned out. A lot of us to blame, but we don't talk about the military.
Yeah.
It's like they try to deflect it. Hey, what about you guys? What are you doing?
Right. It's for national defense.
The national defense and, you know, all the training that goes on. You know, I don't just, okay. You know.
We've got a naval air base on Whidbey Island, and those guys are 24 hours a day up in the air just flying around and around, you know, getting their hours in so that they can do what they, quote, have to do. And, but, you know, one of the things I feel marginally guilty about is those jets, you know, commercial jets. They don't have any pollution control devices on those things. They start out with, I don't know how many thousands of gallons of, you know, jet fuel and burn it all up, you know, just to get you from here to wherever you're going in a more convenient and pleasurable, faster way. That's something to think about, too, you know, I mean, Karen and I love to travel, and I know that's not a sustainable thing we're doing, you know. I mean, look at all the people flying over out here to Seattle to go to Holden, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, to bring it right back home.
Yeah. Well, I think that that in our personal lives, it is important to think of the example that we're setting. It's hard to wag your finger at somebody else when you're driving a 6,000-pound vehicle that gets 12 miles a gallon. You know, I suppose there are some people who really do have to have such a vehicle, but I don't know any personally.
Well, especially when you see those people driving on the freeway in a huge suburban, and they're the only person in the vehicle or something, or, you know, that always gets me. You know, I feel like, especially after that Bush Cheney policy came, I think it was March, April, I don't know, but I felt very guilty about myself. That's how I felt. I don't think I should feel guilty at all. I think there's probably more that I could do, yes, definitely. But in a general sense, am I the person to blame? I don't think so, because I'm not, I don't know. And that really got me, because I'm in this, you know, Jason, like, why the heck? What? is it me? No, it's not necessarily me, it's all of us.
Yeah.
But I felt horrible after that.
Yeah, I think guilt is not a good motivator. If all you're working for is the expiation of your sins, you're just not going to feel very good about it. I mean, it's nice to be cleansed, but on the other hand, if you feel that what you're doing is something positive, that is actually going to help, and not just shrive you, I think it's easier to keep that up. I take a great deal of pleasure, sometimes even verging on joy, in educating people about the natural environment, and in participating in work parties with people of all ages, with families, whether it's a weed pull or you know, so stream restoration project, planting, pruning, monitoring, all of those things are affirmative activities, and they're things that you can involve yourself with a lot of people and, you know, actually get out there and do something. And in the great scheme of things, I think the impact is more on other people than it is on the earth directly, but it's the impact on other people that I think is critical, because until we win the hearts and minds of other folks, we are going to be faced with all the frustrations that we have about what political leaders are up to.
And they're just a reflection of us.
Yeah, well.
They really are.
Right, they felt it was safe to move to a different policy, or, you know, if you had a race taxes a certain area, they would, you know, it's just, it's kind of a, they have a perception that you're going to be out the next election if you are labeled that you raise taxes. I mean, at least in our state, I think that's really true.
Yeah, I don't think everyone has an aptitude for environmental work, but for those who do, you know, it's, in a way, it's a gift that ought not to be squandered. You know, some people are just going to be much better at something else. But if you have some feeling for nature, not necessarily a technical background, but just an affinity for the natural world, to be able to convey that to somebody else is, well, it's redemptive of the earth. I'd like to conclude. Is there anybody who would like to add something before I get into my...
I would just affirm a couple of things that you said, just, you know, to actually work with people to do a project, I think is so beneficial, and it's experiential. And the other point that you made about that you need to be able to stand in another person's shoes to expect what they're going to say with your argument and kind of live through that. I think those two points are just excellent. And my own personal statement for Care of the Earth is my painting, because I paint in watercolor, and I spend time to do that to show other people the beauty that I see. And I think that the actual work of art is also a work of stewardship and a way of sharing the beauty and influencing others. So I think artists also play a big part in that.
Mm-hmm.
Photographers also.
Yeah. You want to say something?
I have a very simple question, and what is happening to our frogs?
Oh, well, that's complicated.
Have they discovered, because I know a year or so ago the mutations that they were discovering, excuse me, and at night you're not hearing them like we used to, and I was wondering if they found out.
Yeah, well, it may in part even be a worldwide phenomenon. Bear frog populations in other parts of the world that are apparently in decline. Part of it could be an increase in ultraviolet radiation from thinning of the ozone layer. Part of it could be declining water quality, and that could introduce some mutagenic substances, things that cause mutations. There also is a fungus infection, apparently, that can cause these strange growths. So it's not one thing, it's a lot of things. That's the best information I have.
Could be a general principle that's creating several of those things, though, you know, I mean, sort of a stress to the ecosystem, so to speak, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even just the temperature raise of 1 degree that we've experienced with global warming.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't sound like anything, but it's 1 degree is a lot bigger deal than in most people's minds.
Right, yeah, and especially for an animal that doesn't regulate its own body temperature. Its temperature is regulated by the outside. It's cold-blooded. Well, let me conclude with something by Gary Snyder, one of my favorite poets. This is Smoky Bear Sutra. Actually, he says it's Smoky the Bear, but you'll get in trouble with people from the Forest Service because Smokey doesn't have a middle name.
Smokey.
He's not like Louis XIV. Once in the Jurassic, about 150 million years ago, the great Sun Buddha in this corner of the infinite void gave a great discourse to all the assembled elements and energies, to the standing beings, the walking beings, the flying beings, and the sitting beings. Even grasses, he's wrong about that, because grasses didn't come along until the Cretaceous or so. But I'll go on. Even grasses, to the number of 13 billion, each one born from a seed, were assembled there. A discourse concerning enlightenment on planet Earth. In some future time, there will be a continent called America. It will have great centers of power called such as Pyramid Lake, Walden Pond, Mount Rainier, Big Sur, Everglades, and so forth. And powerful nerves and channels such as Columbia River, Mississippi River, and Grand Canyon. The human race in that era will get into troubles all over its head and practically wreck everything in spite of its own strong, intelligent Buddha nature. The twisting strata of the great mountains and the pulsings of great volcanoes are my love burning deep in the earth. My obstinate compassion is schist and basalt and granite to be mountains to bring down the rain. In that future American era, I shall enter a new form to cure the world of loveless knowledge that seeks with blind hunger and mindless rage, eating food that will not fill it. And he showed himself in his true form of Smoky Bear. Mm-hmm. A handsome, smoky-colored brown bear standing on his hind legs, showing that he is aroused and watchful. Bearing in his right paw the shovel that digs to the truth beneath appearances, cuts the roots of useless attachments, and flings damp sand on the fires of greed and war. His left paw, in the mudra of comradely display, indicating that all creatures have the full right to live to their limits, and that deer, rabbits, chipmunks, snakes, dandelions, and lizards all grow in the realm of the Dharma. Wearing the blue work overalls, symbolic of slaves and laborers, the countless men oppressed by a civilization that claims to save, but only destroys. Wearing the broad-brimmed hat of the West, symbolic of the forces that guard the wilderness, which is the natural state of the Dharma and the true path of man on Earth. All true paths lead through mountains. With a halo of smoke and flame behind, the forest fires of the Kali Yuga, fires caused by the stupidity of those who think things can be gained and lost. Whereas in truth, all is contained vast and free in the blue sky and green earth of one mind.
This is not the food now stuff, right?
This is Make My Earth Day. And we'll be done in about 3 minutes.
All right.
Round belly to show his kind nature and that the great earth has food enough for everyone who loves her and trusts her. Trampling underfoot wasteful freeways and needless suburbs, smashing the worms of capitalism and totalitarianism. Indicating the task, his followers becoming free of cars, houses, canned food, universities, and shoes, master the three mysteries of their own body, speech, and mind, and fearlessly chop down the rotten trees and prune out the sick limbs of this country, America, and then burn the leftover trash. Wrathful but calm, austere but comic, Smoky Bear will illuminate those who would help him, but for those who would hinder or slander him. Thus his great mantra. He will put them out. Nama Samantha Vajranam Chanda Mahoroshana Spataya Humtrakahamam. I dedicate myself to the universal diamond. Be this raging fury destroyed. And he will protect those who love woods and rivers, gods and animals, hobos and madmen, prisoners and sick people, musicians, playful women, and hopeful children. And if anyone is threatened by advertising, air pollution, or the police, they should chant Smoky Bear's war spell. Drown their butts,
crush their butts, drown their butts, crush their butts. And Smokey Bear will surely appear to put the enemy out with his Vajra shovel. Now those who recite this sutra and then try to put it in practice will accumulate merit as countless as the sands of Arizona and Nevada, will help save the planet Earth from total oil slick, will enter the age of harmony of man and nature, will win the tender love and caresses of men, women, and beasts, will always have ripe blackberries to eat and a sunny spot under a pine tree to sit at, and in the end, will win highest perfect enlightenment. Thus we have heard. Okay, I gotta catch a boat.
Thank you.
Thank you.